Did Pope Francis defy the church's prohibition on allowing same-sex attracted men into the seminaries? A popular video game gets the Pride Month treatment. Will Twitter become the new home for adult sexually explicit content? And finally, will the Trump conviction actually help him in the election? All that and more coming up on this episode of Even Keel with Kyle Kopey. Even Keel, the show where we provide a level-headed take on all things going on in the culture and in the church. Just like the keel of a ship keeps it stable, we encourage you to remain steadfast amid the stormy seas of our pilgrim journey here on Earth. Welcome back. Glad to have you. Let's jump right into it. Pope Francis says to go ahead with your vocation to a would-be, to an aspiring seminarian who's been trying to get into seminary for who knows how many years. And this man has a same-sex attraction. He identifies as gay, whatever that means. This comes on the heels of the, what we call the bagotry statement. Allegedly, in a closed-door meeting with Italian bishops, we remember a few weeks ago that the Pope allegedly said that there's too much bagotry in the seminaries. We don't know if that was a mistranslation, if he actually said it, if he didn't know what he was saying, if he did know what he was saying. There's all kinds of hearsay around this topic, this story. Did the Pope say it or not? If he did, is he backtracking here and telling this seminarian who emailed him, apparently, that you can go ahead with your vocation, even if you are same-sex attracted, which seems to contravene what the church has stated on the allowance of these type of men in the seminaries. So this was reported to an Italian newspaper. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce which one it was, but this man apparently reached out to, or the newspaper reached out to him. He's an Italian man by the name of Lorenzo Caruso. He's 22 years old, and he's been apparently denied access, admittance to seminaries because of his same-sex attraction. Lorenzo Caruso, 22, identifies as gay. According to him, he identifies as gay, and there's a little bit of a problem with that statement to begin with. And for that reason, he's been denied admittance to, I would imagine, at least a few seminaries. I would ask people like this, what do you mean by gay? What do you mean that you identify as gay? Because many, and I believe rightly so, for them, if you use the word gay, if you say, I am gay, if you use that statement, it connotates a certain lifestyle, a certain engagement with that lifestyle. Now, many people will argue that it simply means that someone has a same-sex attraction, but I think words are important here. Recently, I read an article by Mike Lewis over at Where Peter Is, who I've corresponded with before, and I appreciate, for the most part, their work and their take on things. They're providing a unique angle, and I think, for the most part, a level-headed angle. But I would take issue with something that Mike Lewis wrote on this recently in a charitable way. It would offer some pushback to him. He wrote an article sort of covering this whole topic that we're talking about, you know, the things that the Pope allegedly said about same-sex attracted seminarians. Mike Lewis writes this in his article. Before going any further, it is important that language is clarified, which I agree. Some conservative Catholics like to draw a distinction between the common terms gay or LGBT and alternate phrases like same-sex attracted or SSA. And I would say I am involved in that camp. I would agree with that. And I think Lewis is taking issue with that. He continues, for many people of faith, the word gay denotes a sexually active homosexual identity, lifestyle, and culture. And I would say that's true. For the most part, I think that when people use that term, That's what they're referring to, is that they've embraced such a culture, not that they're trying to fight against it or struggle with it, even if they have the attraction. Terms like SSA are preferred because they suggest that one should not be defined by a culture. So he's describing someone with my position. It is associated with support group programs such as Courage or practices like reparative therapy. I would say not always, not always. You could still use this term because I think it's more philosophically accurate. I think it's a better descriptor of people who have SSA as a whole, whether they embrace the lifestyle or not. In common parlance, however, gay has become a standard term for a male homosexual who is romantically and/or sexually attracted to other men. Is it, though? I would take issue with that. I would say, for the most part, it's not. It's people who've embraced that culture, not just who struggle with it. Often, gay Christians and former Christians reject terms like SSA as offensive or patronizing. This is just nonsense. It's an accurate descriptor of what it is. Do you have a same-sex attraction? Are you attracted to people of the same sex? Okay, then SSA is a fine term, in my opinion. Lewis continues, especially if they have a negative experience with. Okay, we covered that one. Even so, some Catholics refuse to use the common terminology. I don't use things just because they're common, and I would argue that it is common that gay refers to people to SSA people of all stripes. I would say it's specifically those who embrace the lifestyle. And why are we letting common culture determine our language, is my question. He concludes, whenever someone mentions gay priests, they insist on associating with a sexually active lifestyle, I think as they should, not orientation. In this article, I use the words gay and LGBT under their common definitions to describe orientation. You could even make an argument that orientation is the wrong word because it sort of connotates being made that way, like God oriented, he turned me towards being SSA and not being attracted to the opposite sex. So there's a whole discussion that which we won't get into now about the misuse of the word orientation. So I would take issue with Mr. Lewis there on that, and I would give him pushback and say that it is confusing to me and to many when someone says, I am gay. Do you mean that you embrace the lifestyle or you're trying to fight against your inclination? Because there is a vast difference between those things. Okay, so back to Mr. Caruso, this 22-year-old would-be seminarian. He emails the Pope, and the Pope emails back a scanned copy of a handwritten letter, which is okay. That seems to, and we don't have the letter, first of all. At least to my knowledge, we don't have the letter, right? I have never seen the letter. I haven't seen anyone reproduce this letter. I would like to see it because I would like to get the full context here. So maybe if someone has it, leave the link, if you're able to, in the show notes. The Pope allegedly emails back with a handwritten letter that says, go ahead with your vocation. Okay. I would say there's some room for ambiguity in there. And we'll explain that in a moment. So the question is, if the Pope allegedly said all this, if he said the thing that he said behind closed doors to the Italian bishops, if he's actually telling this would-be seminarian to go ahead and pursue a vocation to the priesthood despite the Vatican's prohibition on such things in 2005 and reiterated again in 2016, how do we square this circle? If that's all true, if we're getting the full story here of what the Pope actually said. How does that jive with the too much bagotry statement in seminaries? Well, first of all, we have to realize that all this is secondhand info. We have a closed door meeting, and we have, things being leaked out from that closed door meeting about what the Pope allegedly said. We have a personal email obtained by a newspaper. So I think there's a lot of room for error here. There's a wide margin of error that we need to take into account. Although it does seem that the Vatican confirmed that Pope Francis did say something that seemed offensive because they issued a sort of apology for it, the Vatican did. But I don't think they've addressed the issue with this Caruso fellow yet. CNA reports that Caruso told the Italian newspaper that he had sent a lengthy email to Pope Francis on May 28th, in which he wrote that he wanted to draw attention to his story and the stories of many who, quote, this is Caruso talking, like me, live at the margins of the church, often forced to hide themselves, to be included in the community, or forced to pay a high price for a refusal of being sincere. Again, what are you being sincere about? Have you actively embraced this lifestyle, or do you merely struggle with it? Because I think people are going to be more open and welcoming to you if you simply say, I'm struggling with it and I'm fighting against it. I mean, it might be embarrassing for sure. We don't all go around and admit our temptations, and this man doesn't even have to do that. But to simply want to acknowledge that he's SSA, I think you can take the courage and do that, but you don't even necessarily have to do that. I don't acknowledge all of my temptations and all of my proclivities to my church community, and neither do you. So this whole idea of forcing to hide your true self, well, it's not your true self. It's the temptation that you happen to struggle with. It's not you. It's something you deal with. Not talking about your temptations is not hiding. You don't have to talk about them. No one is forcing you to talk about them. If they're so important to you as to where they become part of your identity, I think there's something wrong there. It's almost just being classy. You know, there are times where we can talk about these things, men's groups with close church friends, but they're not, you know, coffee and donuts after mass type of conversation with people that we barely know. Think about it if you're a heterosexual priest. I've said this before. They don't go around and flaunt the fact that they're attracted to the opposite sex. So why should these would-be seminarians? CNA continues, the 22-year-old from La Spezia in northern Italy reportedly told the Pope about his belief he has a calling to the Catholic priesthood and how he was not accepted into seminary after revealing his sexual identity. He also asked the church to reconsider its prohibition on admitting homosexual people into the seminary, as stated in a 2005 instruction from the Congregation for Catholic Education. Okay. I would say to that, just because you think you have a calling to the priesthood doesn't mean you actually have a calling. There are many men, myself included, I've lived this. I was convinced in my early 20s that, like this man, I had a calling to the priesthood. I did not. Looking back on it now, many years later, I can see clearly that I did not have a vocation or didn't have a vocation at the time for several reasons, but I had to be convinced by God otherwise, and he did that, obviously. I'm a married man now, a happily married man, and that's what I was being called to. Just because you think you have a vocation doesn't mean you actually have the vocational call. And then this whole idea where he's asking the Pope to reconsider the church's prohibition, this is long-standing. It's not just this 2005 document. There's other documents as well. There's good moral and theological reasons why we shouldn't admit same-sex attracted men to the seminary. First of all, we have this whole concept in the church of avoiding the near occasion of sin. How appropriate would it be for a man with SSA to live around other men? Think about that. Oh, it's as long as they're celibate, right? That's what they always default to. As long as they're celibate, right? Well, how exactly is that going to work when you have monks and nuns living together? And we're expecting none of them are going to be tempted to fornicate. It's the same thing with SSA men living around men that they're potentially attracted to. Why would we do that? And then the last thing on this, I would just question, and this is probably being too charitable, but I would question what exactly the Pope allegedly meant if he said this, go ahead with your vocation. This is why I want to see the actual document of what the Pope actually wrote. What does go ahead with your vocation mean? Is he telling him to go ahead with your vocation as a child of God to live out your struggle with being afflicted with SSA? Is that what the Pope's telling him? Or is he actually saying, hey, go and go to a different seminary, try to get in, which would seem to, again, contradict what the church has already laid out in terms of seminary acceptance guidelines. So did Pope Francis, or was he just trying to be nice? He's like, yeah, go ahead. Now, you're not going to get in, but yeah, go ahead and try, buddy. I don't know. Those could be wild interpretations, but I'm just putting them out there. Is So if Francis was saying go ahead and try to get into the seminary, is Francis gonna pull some strings to get him there? Is he talking to vocations director? I mean, he's the Pope for crying out loud. He could obviously get anyone into the seminary he wants. At the end of the day, it might be something like this. It might be akin to a father giving advice, and playing along with his kid, who wants to be a superhero. He's like, "Yeah, buddy, you can be a superhero. Go ahead and try to fly," type of thing. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe it's not. I don't know. It remains to be seen of what was actually said here to this young man. All right, let's pause for a word from our sponsors.
Happy Pride. I'm Brian Massengale. I'm obviously a Catholic priest. I'm obviously a black man. And not so obvious is that I'm also openly gay.
Sorry, just kidding. Brian Massengale is not a sponsor of this program. I can't get over that video. Anyways, the real sponsors are few and far between. If you want to be a sponsor for this show, we encourage you to do so. But we encourage you to like this video, subscribe to St. Dominic's Media if you haven't done so already, and join our free membership. Go ahead and over to stdominicsmedia.com. That's Dominic's with an S, and enter your email. You'll get access to exclusive content and a bunch of good stuff. Or consider becoming an exclusive member for just $10 introductory for the first month, and then $5 thereafter. Or also consider becoming a one-time fee only, a lifetime member. We call you the Hound of Heaven, just like Saint Dominic himself. And that's for the low, low price of, I think, around $360. You pay one time for the rest of your life. That's it. And you get access to everything. So head on over to stdominicsmedia.com, and we'll have more exclusive content for you coming up in the future. Okay. Moving on now, I had the pleasure recently of sitting down and having a conversation with writer Sam McCarthy. Sam is a writer over at the Washington Stand, among other things that he does. And we talked about several topics. Sam is a prolific writer. Check him out over at the Washington Stand. And we talked about several things going on in the culture and in the church right now. So I'm excited to bring Sam on for the first time. And I hope you enjoy this interview as well. Welcome back, everyone. I am joined by my friend and former colleague, Sam McCarthy. Sam is a writer over at the Washington Stan. He's also been published by the American Spectator, Real Clear Investigations, and Crisis Magazine. He graduated from McDaniel College in Westminster, Maryland, with a degree in English Literature and Communication, and is one of the most prolific and, I would say, exciting and fun to read authors, writers that I personally know. So this is the first time I want to welcome Sam McCarthy to Even Keel. Sam, thanks so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for the kind introduction, Kyle. Really appreciate it.
Yes. And full disclosure, Sam and I are former colleagues. We used to work in Catholic media together way back in the day, so it's great to be sharing a stage with you once again. So let's jump right into it. As I said, you're a prolific writer over at the Washington Stand, putting out articles every day, so I encourage people to go check that out. I want to talk about just a few of the articles that you've written recently that touch upon culture, politics, and what it has to do with our faith. First up, we have Groomers versus Gamers, a particular beloved game, long-standing history amongst gamers. They love this game. I even played a little bit of it back in the day. It is getting the Pride Month treatment. So if you could tell us, Sam, what game is it and what exactly are they doing to it? How has the Pride agenda infiltrated this game?
Yeah, well, I mean, the game is Call of Duty, which I'm gonna be honest, I never played much. I would play it at like friends' birthday parties and everything, and I'd always get slaughtered. I was never good. I was most of the time I'd be looking at the wrong screen. I'd be up in the right-hand corner. I'm looking bottom left. And thinking, wow, I'm doing really well. And somebody's like, Sam, you got killed for the 15th time. And I'm like, what? Where am I? So, but it's
Happens all
Call
the
of Duty.
time.
All the time. And I was very happy to be able to start an article, a serious article in a serious publication with the phrase "press F to pay respect," because the LGBT agenda has, it's finally taken Call of Duty, which, Call of Duty chat rooms are notorious for being, let's just say, not terribly friendly to LGBT feelings and such, or really anybody's feelings, if we're going to be honest. I think that's kind of ripe territory for searching for these alleged hate crimes. But they've got this new package, I think they call it, a downloadable. You can now decorate your gun in rainbow flags and transgender flags. And to me, the most shocking or most kind of horrific part of this is that you can get machine gun bullets that have the transgender flag decorating them, which, given the rise, especially over the past year or two, in those who identify as transgender shooting up schools and such, I think that it's egregious. I think that somebody either really realized what they were doing and is trying to get canceled, or just has is just the most callous person on the face of the planet. I mean, that's heartless to do that.
Right, yeah, we've certainly seen a lot of that in the news, and they always try to hide it from us. They try to say, or they try to spin it as, oh, this was sort of a conservative person, a gun-toting person who was going to go shoot up a school somewhere. And then we do a little bit deeper dive into the person's background, and sometimes you even don't even have to do that deep of a dive. We read their manifesto, we look at their lives, and we're like, oh no, they were actually on the left. So it kind of totally plays against their narrative there. What does this mean for all the young men out there who gravitate towards these types of games? I mean, you point out that young men are sort of at a very early age training for war. What does this mean for all the young men who are have now come into their adulthood and even older teenagers who are playing this game, who are, sort of living out that maybe fantasy, if you will, but it's sort of a good masculine thing. What does this mean for them?
There's the common kind of, I don't know what you call it, a trope joke of the dad, just needing a break. And so he just goes and sits on the toilet for 20 minutes. Maybe he really has to use the bathroom, maybe he doesn't. This would be like if the stuff that you're trying to get a break from follows you into the bathroom. You sit down on the toilet and suddenly, there's dirty dishes in the bathtub and there's, laundry on the floor, and you're like, oh, come on, like I'm trying to get away from this. It's the same idea. We've had these, and I think that this has not gotten enough attention because there's so much attention, not wrongly placed, but there's so much attention placed on the disappearance of women's spaces. The transgenders being allowed into women's locker rooms, into women's bathrooms, taking over women's sports. And that is concerning because women are vulnerable in a way that men are not. They're particularly vulnerable to men in a way that men are not, biological men, which is trans women or whatever they're calling it. And so that needs to be defended. But what also needs to be defended is men's spaces and boys' spaces, because the men are the ones who are going to have to do the defending, And it's this disappearance and this feminization of these spaces, which is really where it started, with trying to feminize these spaces and turn boys' games, boys' activities, everything. I remember a TV ad. I don't remember even what product it was for, but it was, two little boys having a fight, sword fight with sticks in the backyard at a barbecue, and one of them gets hurt. One of them falls off the top of the play set or whatever and bangs up his arm. And one of the moms just shrugs and says, "Oh, boys will be boys," and she's kind of the villain of the piece. The other mom is like, "Oh my gosh, no, you poor thing. Boys shouldn't be fighting. They should be, they should learn to like love each other and take care of them." Boys are going to fight, okay? It's just who we, and at the end of the day, you want boys to fight. At the end of the day, you want boys who can fight, who will fight. And especially with this new threat posed to women by transgenderism and all that, and the increase of kind of warped masculinity and absence of masculinity, you want men who can fight, and so you're going to need the boys out with sticks and swords and all that stuff. So this disappearance of men's spaces where boys kind of are fostered to do that, I think that's terribly alarming, and it's going to have really negative consequences for society and for culture going forward.
Yeah, you're right. It's really that preparing of young men at a very young age, even from toddler years, to do something that they could be called upon to do, certainly in an explicit sense in war, but also just fighting the daily battles that come with just trying to live out our faith in a secular world. It reminds me of a funny story of the kid falling off the playset type of thing. I have a few boys myself, and yeah, we let them play. We let them, to a certain degree, a measured sense, fight. And it's funny, they turn everything into a gun, no matter what it is. You give them a broom, they turn it into a gun. It's everything's guns for them, and which is fine. We have one daughter, and she turns even guns, the boys' toy guns, into vacuum cleaners. So go
That's funny.
figure. Yeah. Yeah, she had it. We have a toy rifle, and she's vacuuming with it. So
I
go
remember
figure.
when I was a kid, my initially at a very young age, my mom didn't want me playing with guns till I was like older, you know? And she eventually gave up on that idea when she gave me, I was two, three, sitting in a high chair. She gave me a plate of toast, and I chewed the toast into the shape of a pistol and started just firing with it. It's
Oh my
inevitable,
gosh.
is my point. You know, it's inevitable. It's not unnatural. It's not unhealthy, and it is necessary. I know you also appreciate the first season of True Detective. I've been introducing my wife to it because she hadn't seen this previously, and I love there's that line in there where Woody Harrelson's character asks Matthew McConaughey's, "Do you think we're bad men?" And he responds. He says, "I don't care. It doesn't make a difference. The world needs bad men. We keep the other bad men from the door.
From the
You need
door.
men who are powerful. You need men who are dangerous, you know, who are capable of doing, to some extent, awful things in order to protect the world from those who would do those awful things without any kind of a moral compass, you know? So I think it's necessary.
Absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes, even as a father, you have to be that, for lack of a better term, that bad man who keeps the evil away from the door of your house. Okay, moving on, talking about, this whole theme is going to develop here by the end of this segment about the degradation of America and of our society. But we're going to stick with in the realm of digital, electronic, social media specifically here. We have X, formerly known as Twitter, officially allowing porn on their platform. I'm a little confused. You're gonna have to fill me in here, Sam, because I am a sort of a social media Luddite in terms of X. I don't have an X. I've never had a Twitter, and I don't plan to. But it was my understanding that you could always get porn on this platform, correct? You would just kind of stumble upon it. So what has really changed here?
Well, so yeah, technically you could always get pornography. I'm not, you know, I'm not 100% certain what the exact standards were previously. I think it was if things were reported as pornographic that there would be some kind of shield put over it where it says like, you know, this image displays, you know, graphic content. Do you want to see it or no? And there was, I know there was talk of potentially outright banning porn now that Elon Musk took over and everything and saying, you know what, this is a porn-free website, you know, you can't post it. If you want to, you know, share a link to your OnlyFans or whatever, fine. Nobody can stop you from sharing a link, but you can't post your, you know, dirty pictures and stuff. What Elon is now saying is taking this idea of, you know, oh, well, I said this is going to be the, you know, hub for free speech, and so I'm going to count porn as free speech. So go ahead, you know, load up all your pornographic images. What they're doing is they're saying that you can post that, you can share that. What they're asking you to do is, as a user or as a content generator, to flag your own content, basically police yourself, so that they can put another one of those shields over it, you know, where it'll say, hey, this image contains nudity or sexually explicit content. do you want to see it or no? And you can click, sure, show it to me, or you just, you know, keep scrolling, which is not really much of a shield, frankly. And that'll be blocked for users who register with a birth date that places them under the age of 18, or users who don't put in a birth date when registering. X notably has no means of, they don't have a mechanism in place to actually verify your birthday. You know, yeah, I can say that I'm, you know, that I fought in World War One, you know, put up, I was born in, you know, 1901 or whatever, you know, and hey, nobody's gonna check, you know, Elon's not gonna show up at my door and go, can I see your license there? You know, doesn't happen. And so there's no verification. So really what they're allowing is anyone, children included, to access porn, and they're, to a certain extent, encouraging the posting of pornography, because although it's been there, it's kind of been a quiet thing. You know, it's kind of been, nobody talks about it much. Nobody really acknowledges that it's there. And there have been calls to ban it, to, you know, get it off the site. Now Elon's saying, hey, I'm blessing this, you know, this as my blessing now. So I think that's just going to take, again, another space that could be wholesome, you know, where good dialogue and debate happens, and just corrupt it further, you know, pervert it unnecessarily. So.
Right. I mean, it's sort of like any type of social media platform. It's a double-edged sword. It can be used for good. It can be used for evil, just like the internet in general. And it also reminds me of kind of the attempt by, you know, various states in our nation to block porn coming into their state. But the way they do that is, I mean, how exactly are they going to do that? It's, oh, you agree that you're over 18. Anyone could click on the button. A kid who's underage could lie and click on the button and say he's over 18. There's really not a lot of, you know, like you said, no one's showing up to your door. No one's the bouncer at the club checking the actual IDs. It just, it's really just not going to happen. X, the company itself, posted this. They wrote this. And you quote this in the article, "We balance this freedom, presumably the freedom to look at porn, by restricting exposure to adult content for children or adult users who choose not to see it. We also prohibit content promoting exploitation, non-consent, objectification," as if porn is not objectification already, "sexualization or harm to minors, or obscene behaviors." My question is, who are the moral gatekeepers over at X that are going to determine, oh, this is objectifying, this is not. This is exploitation, this is not. Who is actually in these videos? They're not checking the IDs of the people being shown in the videos and saying, oh, this is a minor, this is not. This, you know, she looks like an adult. How are they, is this not going to possibly backfire and end up in the hands of children? And even adults like, you know, you and me, who are checking Twitter and trying to see news, and then this pops up on our feed. How are they going to prevent that?
Yeah, well, I don't think that there really is, short of actually banning porn, like, you know, it's been suggested that they do. I don't think that there is much of a way that they can do that. It's going to be very difficult to police this, especially because you do have those very subjective standards. You know, you have, let's say, one moderator who, you know, has seen porn maybe once in his life, you know, somehow. You know, he's going to have a very different idea of what's obscene and what's, you know, objectifying than, say, a guy who looks at porn five times a day, you know, for the past 22 years. He's going to have a very different idea. You know, he's going to see, they can both see the same image, and the one guy will say, oh my gosh, that's awful. I think that we got to classify that as pornographic. We got to maybe get it off the site. And the other guy's going to say, you kidding me? That's Friday night. What are you talking about? You know?
Yeah.
So you're really going to have this discrepancy in standards as far as policing it, and you're going to have difficulty actually policing it. You're certainly going to have difficulty preventing children from seeing it and preventing it from being used against children, because pornography is a key element in sexual grooming of children. It's become a key element in transgenderism and in the idea of kids, you know, developing a new gender identity. You know, pornography has been demonstrated to play a pivotal role in that process. So you're really going to have a difficult time, short of banning the thing outright, trying to police it. And I think they're going to end up wasting so much time, energy, money, resources, etc. on this that my hope is that eventually Elon's just going to reach a point where he says, you know what, this isn't even worth it just from a purely financial aspect. We're just going to ban it. You know, we're just going to give the crowd what they want because there's far more calls to ban it than there is to keep it. So I would really hope that they ban it eventually outright.
Yeah, it's been Elon's sort of long-standing philosophy that he's not going to censor anything that's illegal, but it raises a moral question of, well, even if you know the country allows something, why does a social media platform have to go along with it? You know, I also read that it's up to the producers of this pornographic content to sort of self-report. They're supposed to mark their own content as pornographic. I mean, can we really trust porn producers? That's number one. And, you know, number two is, I mean, you quoted Joseph Blackholm in the article is basically alluding to the fact that, well, Twitter might become the new primary place to view pornographic material.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really trust them to kind of not self-censor, but kind of self-designate their pornographic material. But even beyond that, if you look at, you know, you mentioned just a minute ago about some of the states that, you know, you get on a porn website and it just asks you, are you over the age of 18? There are a number of states, about a third of them now, I believe. Excuse me, about a third of states have put in place measures to actually verify properly age in order to access pornographic websites. And Pornhub, the number one major porn website in the world, is completely shut down in almost all of those states. Completely shut down. Not just like, you know, oh, well, nobody can access it. They make their own decision and they say, you know what? Nobody's going to access us. If you can't allow kids on our site, you know, who are lying about their age, then we don't want anybody on our site. We're going to run into the same thing here. Who do you think is running this stuff, profiting from it, producing this stuff? I mean, you're really going to think that they're going to just say, oh, okay, well, we'll self-report. Oh, well, I don't want Elon to get mad at me, so we're going to self-report this, you know? That's not going to happen. It's going to become, again, just weaponized. It's going to be used to target children in particular, but to target everybody. Because, I mean, it is a horrifically, terribly addictive substance, you know? And so it's going to be used to target anybody and everybody eventually for some kind of profit, whether financial or spiritual. But it is going to be used to target everybody and in particular children. So I just think that the whole system is deeply intrinsically flawed.
Right. As the Skittles crowd is often fond of saying, we're coming for your children, and that's exactly what they're doing. Let's sort of broaden the scope here, still sticking with the theme of the moral decline of our nation, but applying this to a specific individual, a very popular individual, and this is former President Donald Trump. We saw late last month now that a New York jury convicted Trump of 34 felony counts. Now, besides the obvious, this is obviously unprecedented that 34 felony counts are leveled against a former president. But besides that obvious fact, why else was this trial so unprecedented? I'm thinking here of things having to do with the prosecutor, things having to do with the judge, and the whole idea of changing this, what probably should have been a misdemeanor, into a felony.
Well, the entire thing, really, you can look at almost any aspect of it, and it's so skewed. It's so politically motivated and just brutalized, really. I mean, the justice system has been brutalized through this process. You have a Democratic district attorney picked up charges that the federal prosecutors already said, you know what, I don't think there's anything to this. We're just going to leave this alone. There's not enough there that we can do anything with it. And so Alvin Bragg, district attorney, picks it up and says, you know what, I'm going to do something with it. These are misdemeanor charges in the state of New York. Falsifying business records is a misdemeanor charge unless they're falsified in order to facilitate or cover up the commission of another crime. Bragg alleged that Trump was making certain payments in order to cover up things in order to influence the outcome of an election, which, first of all, is not necessarily a crime. That's what everybody does with advertisements. That's what everybody does with, you know, their campaigns, your speeches, everything, you know, from having other people pick out your tie and do your hair. You're trying to influence the outcome of an election and you're doing it legally. But he's saying that that's a crime that Trump has committed, that he's committing this misdemeanor offense in order to cover it up. Therefore, even though that first crime, either first of all, isn't a crime, and second of all, hasn't been proven, he's going to elevate this to a felony charge. So you've got 34 felony charges now. The trial is keeping Trump off the campaign trail. It's keeping him locked up in the courthouse where it's, you know, so boring and he's falling asleep, which was, you know, making headlines. It's insane. And then you've got the whole thing being presided over by a judge who is a Democrat. He's donated to Joe Biden in 2020. His daughter runs a Democratic consulting, a political consultancy firm or agency. And she's done work with Biden and his current campaign. So the whole thing is just, it's skewed from the beginning. And then the very fact that it's in one of the most Democratic districts ever. And, you know, they asked for a venue change. They said, hey, we don't think that we can get a fair trial here because, you know, let's face it, everybody hates Trump here. Can we move it somewhere where maybe, you know, there's a fair mix? And they said, no. Hey, can we ask for maybe a judge who, you know, didn't donate money to this guy's political opponent? You know, no. Can we ask the judge to recuse himself? No. This whole thing is just skewed. It's this brutalization of the justice system, really.
No, it really is, and it's unprecedented. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said this. He said that if this were any if this were happening to anyone but Trump, it wouldn't have happened. We wouldn't even know about it. But it's really the left's weaponization of the juridical system to try to, in any way possible, because it's not going to keep him from running. It's not going to keep, you know, it's not going to make Trump drop out of the race, but it's going to at least attempt to put a chink in his armor, as you said, to keep him at least off the campaign trail. And do you think this is going, what sort of prediction do you have as to how this is going to affect the Trump campaign? What is this going to hurt Trump in the election? A lot of people are actually saying the opposite. I think you noted independent candidate RFK Jr. He said this is actually going to help Trump. This is, you know, going to galvanize support for him. And you noted, you know, we had donations pouring into Trump. So, you know, most of the country thinks that these juridical proceedings against Trump are politically motivated on both sides of the aisle. They agree with that. And so, yeah, your thoughts on this. Will this help or hurt Trump, do you think?
I think it will on a grassroots level, kind of on like a, you know, polling place level. I think it'll definitely help him. I think that it already has. His campaign just announced, I think last night, they've received something like $400 million in donations since the conviction. $400 million since, that's insane, over such a short period of time. You know, they've blown Biden's, you know, campaign war chest out of the water. You know, he did that fundraiser with, you know, Joe Biden, Barack Obama, and Bill Clinton, you know, three Democratic presidents all hanging out together. You can get a photo with all of them. That's crazy. And Trump just, it didn't even have a party, you know, just it gets convicted, $400 million. Here you go. Like, I think that, and I know a lot of people too, like good friends of mine, people who are, you know, prominent conservatives who were not going to support Trump, who had, you know, doubts or questions, you know, like, well, I like a lot of what he did, but, you know, I'm just not sure that he's the right guy for right now, you know, or, oh, well, I would have preferred someone else like DeSantis. At this point, everybody is on board. Everybody's putting on their MAGA hat and getting ready to go out to the voting booth. So I think that on a grassroots, on a polling place, people kind of level, definitely helping Trump. But again, he's now a convicted felon. They can do, from kind of the top down side of things, they can do almost anything to him now. They can throw him in prison, you know? They can do almost anything. They can engineer anything. And they're going to keep hitting him. They're going to keep using the, oh, he's a convicted felon. He's a convicted. Biden starts touting that literally the day after the conviction, you know? And of course, now he's putting out this press statement, you know, Biden's team putting out this press statement warning that, oh, well, hey, if Donald Trump gets reelected, remember, he wants to target Democrats and he wants to try to put Democrats in prison. Isn't that what you're doing? They recognize that targeting a political opponent is wrong. They're just absolving themselves and saying, but it's okay when we do it because we're right and you guys are scum. Your ideas, your Christianity, your, you know, heterosexuality, you're scum. So everything that Trump is standing up for, you know, your family, your wallet, your paycheck, all of that, it's filth to us. We don't care. And so we're going to throw him in prison.
Which they may do. We have the sentencing slated for July 11th. We'll see if it actually happens on that date or if it gets pushed back. So that kind of remains to be seen. So we're talking about a former president in more contemporary history. Let's talk about some former presidents more remote in American history and some other American leaders and what they may have to think about this situation if they could hop in a time machine. You wrote another recent article called If You Can Keep It, America's Foundation is Crumbling But Not Lost. And let's touch on a theme we kind of touched on earlier, and it's a sort of this demonic idea of Pride Month, which is this month. Pride Month, I would say, is not about tolerance. It's not just live and let live, right? So what does the left mean by acceptance?
They mean acceptance in the same sense that, you know, one of the medieval Vikings might have meant accepting Odin, you know, as you bend over a tree stump with his sword against your throat, you know. Pride Month is really, it's, you know, we have, as Catholics, we have June as the month of the Sacred Heart. You know, when we commemorate, remember, and increase our devotion to Christ's Sacred Heart, which is a holy experience. It's a devotion meant to sanctify us. And we have Archbishop Fulton Sheen explained that Satan is the ape of the church. That's a very famous quote from Sheen. Satan is the ape of the church, you know, and so Satan is sort of trying to set up his own anti-church. Much less famously, Monsignor Robert Hugh Benson, in his book, The Lord of the World, kind of tries to, back in 1907, tried to kind of anticipate or predict what this anti-church, what this aping of the church might end up looking like. And he comes to the conclusion that even though it's purely atheistic, humanistic, it's worshiping, you know, it's narcissistic, worshiping the self, the human as God, you know, everybody is his own messiah, that kind of idea, that it eventually necessitates actual liturgical worship. And I think that that's really what we're seeing with something like Pride Month. It is their own holy month. You know, it's sort of like the left-wing Ramadan, the left-wing Lent, you know, the left-wing Advent. It's their holy month, you know, where they praise one of these things that is one of their sacraments, you know? And so I think that really Pride Month has become this evangelistic sort of thing that kind of doesn't so much try to, as Christians may, you know, elevate the mind and reason in order to facilitate conversion to truth, but rather dulls the intellect and subjects reason to appetite and to passion so that the appetites can then go where they will and can then pursue whatever debauched degeneracy is being favored or promoted this month.
You wrote in your article that Pride Month is not a grassroots achievement, but an innovation of the elite. You know, it seems to me that everyday people don't really want to pay attention to this stuff. it's if it is at a grassroots level, it's a very, very small minority of people who are affected by this and feel affected by this and feel like they want to rise up and protest or be an activist or whatever. But everyday common red-blooded American doesn't want this on their radar. They don't want to hear about it. So, it's interesting because if you were to get out your time machine and transport the founding fathers into contemporary society, what would they say at everything going on? And back then, when they were framing the Constitution, did they have any foresight to prevent these aberrations based on their own intellectual and spiritual formation?
Yeah, I'd say they did. One of the things is the founding fathers were a sort of, I don't want to quite say motley crew, but they were an intellectually and ideologically fairly diverse set of folks. You had, kind of different wings, different factions. But I can tell you, I was actually just reading the other day legislation that had been drafted and proposed by Thomas Jefferson, who was known as kind of the liberal's liberal, very, very kind of, law should kind of let everybody do what they want. It should really only come in at the most serious of times to restrict people's actions. He proposed a law making sodomy, homosexual act, crime punishable by mutilation, physical mutilation. Men would have, fingertips and body parts removed. Women would have, I think it's their nostril cut open, for engaging in this. That was in what, 1780 something. I think that they would be certainly appalled, if they saw what was happening today. And there is this sort of notion, you especially hear it with guns, oh, well, the founding fathers, when they wrote about guns, they only had, flintlock muskets, They didn't know that you were going to end up with, AR-15s or AK-47s, Yeah, but like the flintlock muskets is what the army had. They had cannons, the army had cannons. They're basically saying that you should have whatever guns the military has, in case that's what you need to fight. And so I think that there's sort of this false notion that, the founding fathers were sort of, cavemen, that they had no idea that any of this stuff could possibly happen. Yeah, they did. Like they knew about this. Thomas Jefferson wrote about this and wanted to put people who do this in prison. He wanted to mutilate them physically by law. So the idea that they had that, like, oh, well, they never anticipated, the gay rights movement and stuff. Yeah, they did, and they had an answer to it. Like, and just the idea that this has come about now, and the founding fathers anticipated this to some extent, and the kind of government that they gave to us is a government of self-responsibility. It's where you are taking care of yourself. You can look at it as, well, the way that I find it helpful to kind of think of it is, a monarchy is sort of very much kind of like a dad taking care of his children. He has a duty, a respect. Sure, he may be a bad dad. He may be an abusive alcoholic. Sure, maybe. But he knows that what he's supposed to do is take care of his children and raise them and love them and teach them properly and do things so that they prosper. That's his job. That's the monarch's job. The kind of government that we have that our founding fathers devised was much more like kind of like the kids have grown up, they're out in the world now. Thanks, Dad, but like I'll make my own decisions now. I understand, you think that that's best for me right now. It's not, sorry. And that does require a degree of maturity that spiritual, moral, and intellectual maturity that is completely lacking today. Like we just talked about, we have an entire month essentially mandated to celebrate homosexual sins, homosexual acts, which up until relatively recently, were taboo. You couldn't hint at it. I remember there was a show back in the I think it was in the 70s, Three's Company. You know that show?
Yep.
This guy was not allowed to, he had to pretend to be, gay and stuff. Like
To live
it
in the
just,
house
yeah, to live
with
in the house.
the two
It just, it's insane. They like that this has become as accepted and as mandated as it is, on a broad cultural level, And it's really indicative of the fact that we do not have that moral or intellectual or certainly not that spiritual maturity, And as you, I think, have been alluding to, it was John Adams who was our first vice president and our second president. John Adams, who also essentially kind of defended our present system of government and helped really define it as essential. Thomas Paine wanted to eliminate the Senate. He wanted there to be only one chamber of Congress. And it was John Adams who stepped in and said, "I'm sorry, but that is far too close to mob rule. We need a bicameral Congress. We need two chambers, so that one can kind of balance out the other." And he was right, because he recognized that there is always the potential to abuse that power if you're morally corrupted. Under different forms of government, moral matters may be legislated. Under our form of government, the American form of government, moral matters were by and large not legislated. You weren't mandated to do this or that or the other thing. They kind of left it up to you and trusted you to shape your conscience, to live a moral life. And we haven't. John Adams said that our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly unsuitable to any other, to the government of any other. We've become that people that it's wholly unsuitable to. I mean, we were just talking about pornography. I'm blown away. Like that my vote counts to say I'm a husband. I'm now a father. I've overcome a lot in my life. I'm well educated. I'm well trained in classic literature, in classic philosophy, in my Catholic catechism. But my vote counts the exact same as some guy who got a vasectomy, works at not that there's anything wrong with Burger King, but say works at Burger King, right? Spends all of his money on pot and OnlyFans and watches pornography 8 times a day. My vote counts the same as his. That's appalling. That's insulting to me. Like, it's just mental that we've reached this point of moral decay.
Yeah, it is real unfortunate to see the country in this state. I don't even want to say headed in this direction because we're already here.
We're there.
We're here. Yeah, we're here, we're there, we're everywhere, unfortunately. We're all over the place. But all, as you write, all is not lost. All is not lost because the solution is a return to morality and religion. And we ultimately have to remember too that even if, God forbid, this great country goes down, we are still citizens of the kingdom of God. Sam McCarthy, we'll have to leave it right there. There's so much more to talk about. And this is just the first installment, the first segment of our little interview thing here. I don't know what we're going to call it, but it's been a good time. Thank you so much for joining me. And we hope to see you next time.
Thanks for having me on, Kyle. Great talking with you.
All right, welcome back. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Sam McCarthy, writer over at the Washington Stand. Go check him out. His author page is linked in the show notes. And that won't be my first conversation with Sam. We'll try to bring him back on as a regular guest because he has, again, a prolific resume in terms of writing, and he's always commenting and providing great commentary about what's going on in the culture. Okay, lastly, as we often do, let us end with some daily defense. Today's topic has to do with God changing his mind. Is God changeless, what we call in philosophy immutable? And if he is, well, then why should we bother praying. What are we doing? Are we trying to convince God that we need something that he knows he's not going to give us? Doesn't he already know what we need? So what's the point in praying and asking for what we think we need when God knows better and he's just going to give it to us or not give it to us? It's really getting at this question of what is prayer? What is the essence of prayer itself? Well, first of all, prayer is not something God needs. Worship is not something God needs. God doesn't need anything. He doesn't need us to pray to him. He doesn't need us to worship him. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't pray to him. That's not to say that we shouldn't worship him. But it doesn't do so much for God as it does for us. Prayer and worship are things that humans ought to do because they're good for humans. They don't add anything to God himself because he is self-sustaining. He is perfectly happy. He is not in want of anything. So prayer is for us, and it draws us out of ourselves. It draws us out of ourselves. It's meant to keep us coming back to God for what we need, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. Thinking about the things we need, we call those things that God gives us acts of providence. God is providing for us. But providence is conditional. It's conditional on us asking for it, sort of like our forgiveness is. God is waiting for us to reach out to him in order for us to get what we need. It's there. God is offering it to us, but he's not necessarily going to give it to us at the time we think we need it, because we simply haven't asked for it yet. Now, there are some things that we think we need, which might even be good things in and of themselves, but we still don't get them, and we're confused. But in those times, I think we just have to realize that God knows better than we do. Sometimes our timing and our expectation of timing and when things come to us is not what God has in mind, and you can rest assured that God knows better, that you might not need the thing or get the thing when you want the thing. So it might be good, but it might not be the right time for us to have that. Forgiveness and providence are sometimes conditional. Certainly forgiveness. You know, one time I heard a Protestant radio show host say some wacky thing. I don't think he was on the air long because he was saying stuff like this, but I heard him say something like, "Stop asking God to forgive your sins. He has already forgiven you." And okay, there's a lot of wonky theology there. Yes, God made it possible. He gave you the opportunity to be forgiven by what the second person of the Blessed Trinity did on the cross, but that's merely the opportunity. You have to take that opportunity upon yourself. You have to accept it. You have to ask for forgiveness. You have to admit to your sins. You have to be sorry for your sins. And then and only then is that forgiveness that happened on the cross applied to you directly. So there's a difference between the act of redemption accomplished by our Lord and the application of that redemption throughout the centuries until the end of time. It's the same thing with providence as well. It's waiting for us if it's there, but we have to reach out to God. We have to make acts of petition. We have to ask God for what we need. Prayer is not about giving God information. God knows all. I mean, the scripture even attests to this. Literally, Jesus says in the Gospels, "The Father knows what you need even before you ask." So prayer is not about telling God what you need. It's about forming a relationship. You go to God to remember that he is the one that's providing you for these things. Prayer keeps us from being totally self-reliant. You know, the big temptation for us nowadays is to deify ourselves in an immoral way. I mean, deification is in a certain sense a Christian concept because we're trying to become more like God and become one day an embracer of the beatific vision as to where we become so close to God as to where ancient Christians talked about us being divinized. Not that we become our own separate gods or we become God himself, but we are so close to God as to where we become what they call divinized. So prayer keeps us from being totally self-reliant. We realize that by our own human effort, we can't accomplish all of our goals and provide for all of our needs. And it does help us with humility. We realize that we're fallible and that we need God's grace to sustain us physically, morally, spiritually, mentally. Prayer helps you and us and all of us fulfill the second part of the greatest commandment, which is love of neighbor. So you think about not just praying for things that you need, those are petitions, but praying for the needs of others. We call those intercessory prayers. We have that part of Mass called the petitions or the intercessory prayers. Lord, hear our prayer for whatever craziness is going on in the world or in our church community. Remember that God is outside of time and changeless, but he can still interact in time. So prayer doesn't change God's mind. God knows what's going to happen. He knows what acts are going to be wrought by his hands in the future, but it doesn't mean they're predetermined just because he knows they're going to happen. That's where people make the mistake. Just because God knows something's going to happen in the future, that's not quite how it works with God because he's outside of time. There's no future for God. But from our perspective, it looks like God knows what's going to happen in the future. It's true because he's already there. He's already experienced all of time at once. It's sort of a philosophical tangent. We won't go down there, but it doesn't change God's mind. God can still interact with things in time. At least that's how it appears from our perspective. And the letters of Saint James sums this up quite beautifully. The fact that God is changeless, but yet can provide things for us. In James chapter 1, verse 17, we read, "Every good endowment and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." So the changeless God affects fallible humanity and a fallen world to provide us with what we need at the proper time if we come back to him in a relationship, in conversation, talking to our loving Father in prayer. Okay, that's about all the time we have for this installment of Even Keel with Kyle Kobe. We'll see you next time. God bless you.